I'm going to talk about Servl, an end-host stack for service-centric networking. So I want to start this talk by kind of looking back in time a bit. So what you see here is a map of the initial deployment of the ARPANET. So this network connected four hosts together, and researchers could use this network to remotely log into a machine to access some resources. So this was really a network designed for accessing hosts. So a researcher at UCSB could remotely log into a machine at Stanford. And the abstractions provided by this design also reflected this model of communication. Today, however, we're accessing services, and these run in huge data centers, are replicated on thousands of machines, and users want to access services by name. And they are kind of agnostic of the location and actual host they're communicating with. But we're still stuck with these kind of age-old abstractions dating back to the initial ARPANET. So part of this talk is actually kind of about asking the question, what new abstractions should we have for enabling service-centric communication? But first, I want to go through what service access actually involves. So first, you'd like to locate a nearby service data center. That means you want to map a service name to a location. Second, you want to connect to that service, which means you establish a data flow. And in the process, you might want to load balance between a pool of replicas in the data center. Third, you might want to maintain connectivity to the service, even though you change your location or switch interface. But because we're using these kind of suboptimal abstractions, we today have to overload the networking abstractions that we have dating back to the ARPANET. So for example, instead of connecting to a service, we connect to an IP address and port, which unnecessarily exposes the location of the service and also the application layer protocol. So if you want to run multiple services, you either have to expose additional IP addresses or use non-standard ports or do some kind of virtual hosting. Also, when we're connected to a service, we use a 5-tuple to demultiplex packets. So this 5-tuple includes the IP address and port of the communication endpoints plus the transport protocol number. And this kind of binds the flow to an interface and location, and you cannot migrate between interfaces or network attachment points. So with suboptimal abstractions, service access today has a number of issues or problems. For example, you want to find the service location, you use DNS, and this kind of binds the service to a location early on in the communication process at the client. And further, both the client and in-network resolvers might cache the IP address and maybe ignore TTLs, which is common, and this further exacerbates this problem, leading to slow failover at the load with load balancing. Once you want to connect to a service, you might want to do in-network load balancing. But because you're naming the service by the IP address, you have to map this to multiple servers. And because of this, you have to sit on the data path and do this for every packet, which leads to fade sharing issues. This also increases the cost and complexity of your service. So here, if the load balancer fails or your flows also break. Once you're connected, you want to maintain connectivity to the service, even if you're kind of migrating VMs in the data center, providing cloud services. And to be able to migrate today, you typically do your build your data center using some kind of flat addressing scheme, or you use tunneling in the data center to move VMs around. Also on the client side, we have similar problems. If you switch between different network technologies, your flows break. So what are the contributions we make here to improve this? Well, first off, we provide new naming abstractions for services and flows, which I will soon define. And this gives a clean role separation in the stack, we think. And around these abstractions, we've built a software architecture for services that we call Servl. And Servl provides a service level control and data plane split that makes it easier to build service resolution. We also provide service level events in the stack that makes it easier to program the control plane. So first off, I want to talk about these naming abstractions. So again, looking back at today's overloaded abstractions, how does Servl actually improve? So Servl kind of cleans the slate here, but not completely. The network layer stays unmodified. And it turns out that when we solve these overloading problems, the network layer kind of reverts back to the simplicity of the initial ARPANET deployment. So an IP address here actually names a host and a location. So what do we actually do to change these obstructions? First off, we add a new layer into the networking stack between the network layer and the transport layer. We call this the service access layer, and it provides two main functions. It resolves and connects to services, and it maintains connectivity to those services. So what are the new identifiers we add to the stack? Well, first off, applications communicate directly on service names, or service IDs as we call them. So service IDs provide a group abstraction that hides the location and composition of a service. A service ID is actually machine readable, and you can acquire a service ID by copying them in emails or resolving them through like DNS, or maybe share them in a social network and so forth. Once you're connected to a service, we use a flow ID to demultiplex packets. So this provides an invariant MUX key, and it's host local and ephemeral, so the underlying network addresses can actually change dynamically once we're communicating. You might notice here that the transport layer doesn't have any identifiers. That's because we're now providing connection establishment and demultiplexing in the service access layer. So we could actually take the Linux kernel's TCP implementation and rip out everything that is not related to the established state. So our transport layer is basically only dealing with data delivery semantics like flow control, congestion control, and data segmentation and so forth. So what this gives you in comparison to the regular TCP/IP stack is a clean role separation. So now we have service IDs naming what you access, namely the service, and over which flows given by the flow IDs, and the IP address simply gives the location. So I want to talk a bit more about service names or service IDs. So we imagine that service IDs are block allocated. So this means that a service provider like Google could acquire a prefix maybe from some body like IANA, and then they can further subdivide this prefix to provide individual services like Calendar or Gmail. And this ensures global uniqueness, and you can aggregate service IDs by prefix and do longest prefix matching for scalability. Optionally, this service ID can end with a self-serving identifier, which is the hash of a public key and the prefix of the service ID, and this provides you a way to do authentication of services without relying on a centralized certificate authority. So service IDs, they late bind to a service instance. So we do this by actually putting service IDs in packets. So the service access layer can actually forward and route on these service IDs to find a service instance. And I will describe later how we do this. Communication on service IDs kind of raises the service awareness of the networking stack. And what this means is that when a client connects to a service ID, the networking stack must resolve this service ID to a location for this client. Similarly, if you're providing a service, you bind to a service ID and you listen for incoming connections, which means the networking stack must advertise the service to the network. So I'm now going to move on to talking about our software architecture that we built around these abstractions. So here's an overview showing the layers. We have the network layer providing basic IP forwarding. And then in the service access layer, we have a service table mapping service IDs to a next hop resolver and performing kind of late binding resolution and connection setup. We also have a flow table that once you've established a connection, you can demultiplex based on flow IDs. In the user space, we have a service controller that basically implements service control plane. It can communicate with the stack using a service control API to add and remove rules to the service table and also migrate flows in the flow table. So let's take a closer look at the service table, which basically implements service control data plane. So the service table maps service IDs using longest prefix matching to one of four actions with associated state. So for example, a forward rule means that you should deliver a matching packet to a next hop resolver, and this could be in a unicast IP address, a broadcast address, multicast address, and it can even be a list of addresses, so you can do round robin on these to provide a kind of a service level anycast. The MUX rule simply means you have a listening applications, and any incoming packets with matching this rule should be delivered to the listening socket to accept this connection. A delay rule means that you can queue the packet in the kernel, you notify the service controller, which can then invoke some kind of other resolution mechanisms like DNS to map this service to a location and then import state into the service table and release the packets. A drop rule simply avoids matching another fault rule, which you can see at the end of the table. So now that we have the service level data plane, how can we use that to provide service resolution? So let's look at an example. We have a client that wants to access a service consisting of two instances and an intermediate host that we call a service router. So the service router manages the pool of replicas. So these instances or replicas can basically register with the service router, which can then provide load balancing. So if you have an instance, how does it register? Well, the application simply binds to a service ID, which adds a demux rule into the service table, allowing you the instance to demultiplex incoming connections. And then you notify the service controller on the host, which can then register with the network, or in this case, the service router. Also, if you close the socket, you automatically remove the demux rule, notify the network. So this service controller can then speak to typically an upstream service controller, which can then further speak to other service controller in the wide area to distribute this service data. You can also choose, because this is implemented in user space, to use another type of protocol like dynamic DNS to update a DNS resolver. You can also speak something like OpenFlow to an SDN-style controller to do kind of joint service network control. If you receive an advertisement for a service, you simply add this rule as a forwarding rule. So this would be the service router in our example. So what we have now is a way for service instances to automatically register with the service router by simply binding to a specific service ID. And now the service router has the proper state to do load balancing. The service router can then decide to disseminate this information or a prefix of this service ID in case you're providing multiple services sharing the same prefix in the data center. Notice also that it's actually advertising its own IP address, so if you have changes in the data center, adding and removing instances, you don't need to re-advertise this information upstream. So eventually, somehow this information reaches the client, which adds some state in its service table and can now resolve this service. So then what it does is to create a socket, which allocates a flow ID for the multiplexing purposes, and then it connects to the service, generates a SYN packet, and here adds information in a new service access layer header, including the service ID and the flow ID. This is sent off according to the service table rule to the next hop resolver, in this case, the service router, which receives this incoming SYN packet, forward this based on the forward rule, picking one of the instances, and then delivers to an instance. So this instance receives the SYN, demultiplexes the packet, delivers to the listening socket, which can then accept the connection, and then create a client socket. Again, it creates a flow ID, and you can generate a SYNAC reply using the proper identifiers here. So what we now have in our example is a way for the client to connect to a service instance. It sends the SYNs to the service router, doing load balancing, selects an instance, and can reply with the SYNAC. So notice here that the SYN actually travels the indirect path via service level forwarding, going through the service router, which can do load balancing. The SYNAC and any future data packets travel the shortest IP route, totally bypassing the load balancer. So with this functionality, you can actually implement the service router in software, maybe even off-the-shelf hardware, because it's only attaching the first packet of the connection. And if the service router fails, the outstanding connections to this service can continue uninterrupted. So what if you don't have a service router and you don't know about any service instances? For example, you're joining a new network with a mobile client and you want to access a printer, for example. So what you do then is you acquire a new address as normal on this network, which automatically adds a default service table rule pointing to the broadcast address of this segment. So when the client connects to a service, it simply broadcasts the SYN on the segment, and any listening instances can reply with a SYNAC. The client can then pick one of these to complete the connection, and typically it picks the first. So this type of ad hoc service discovery you can use to actually find or bootstrap into a larger resolution network, so you can find your local service router. So again, looking back at how we access services. Now we have a way to locate nearby service data center, to map a service to a location, connect to the service, establish a flow, and do load balancing. And now we want to maintain connectivity to the service, even though we migrate between interfaces or networks. So it turns out that when we kind of solve this overloading problem, it becomes pretty straightforward to support migration. So let's look at an example. Here we have a flow established between two hosts on a pair of interfaces. They've allocated their flow ID so they can easily demux this. And if we have a failure on one of the links, you can simply renegotiate which interface you're using for this flow. So we're using here an rsyn handshake for resynchronize. You can also use this migration to actually move between different networks. So because we're providing this functionality in the service access layer, you can actually reuse this functionality among many different transport protocols. So it's easy to provide migration support for even future transport. Also, using similar mechanisms, you can establish multiple subflows for using multiple paths. So you simply do a new handshake, adding a flow to the existing connection or socket. So it's easy or straightforward to implement something like multipath TCP. So we've actually implemented basically everything I've been describing except the multipath support. It's implemented as a Linux kernel module, and you can insert this module on a running kernel without modification. It provides a BSD sockets API using a new address family called AFServal, and you can simultaneously access the old TCP IP stack using AF INET sockets. You can first try Serval and then fall back to a regular TCP IP connection. We also support traversal of legacy middle boxes, and we can traverse NATs using UDP encapsulation. We also have a translator for incremental deployment, so you can actually use unmodified apps to communicate with Serval end hosts, or Serval apps to communicate with unmodified services. So this is an example of how we can use this translator. You have an unmodified client speaking TCP IP to a data center that has some point of presence where it's deployed a translator, and you speak Serval in the data center, allowing you to, for example, migrate VMs easily. You can also move the translator to the client. So this allows the client to migrate between different interfaces like 3G and Wi-Fi. And then you're speaking Serval in the wide area, either to a Serval speaking data center or through a translator translating back to TCP/IP, allowing access to legacy services. So this actual setup we see here, we used in an experiment where a student of ours took a walk from his dorm to our computer science department at the campus at Princeton. And during this walk, he was streaming music from Google Music to his mobile phone, and the service controller on the mobile device was automatically switching between Wi-Fi and cellular connectivity. And you can see here in the plots the different types of connectivity achieved, and the gradient is showing the signal quality used by the controller to decide when to switch between these network interfaces. So we're using here a single Serval TCP connection during this entire walk. So we did some back of the envelope calculations on the data savings you can use on cellular. So if you take this walk twice a day for like 20 days a month, you save around 900 megabytes of cellular data. And this is basically half of most wireless data plans today. You can also use migration on servers to provide load balancing between interfaces. So in case you have multiple NICs on your server, you can accept, for example, two clients, as in this example, on one interface where they initially share the bandwidth of that link. And then after a couple of seconds, you can move one of the flows to a secondary interface so that both clients can achieve the full throughput of both links. And you can use this functionality to, for example, move elephant flows to a secondary interface, maybe connected to a different network. You can also use our migration protocol to migrate VMs across the wide area or within a data center that has multiple subnets. So in this case, we're showing a VM moving from one subnet to another and acquiring a new IP address after the migration. So during this IP address acquisition, you see a short interruption in the data flow, and then the VM can quickly recover once the IP address is assigned. So this is a single TCP connection. So our stack has pretty competitive performance because we basically took the Linux TCP implementation and added to our stack. So we basically have the same performance. If there's some difference, it's due to the fact that we're not doing hardware checksumming of segments, due to the fact that we have new headers in the packet and this checksumming mechanism doesn't understand this. But we're actually within the standard deviation here. Our translator has pretty high performance too. That's because we're doing in-kernel zero copying of datagrams between two sockets. The service table throughput for service resolution sees a slightly higher performance hit compared to IP forwarding, and that's because we currently don't have a really optimized data structure for longest prefix matching. So we think that if we add optimizations like caching of entries and so forth, we can actually achieve a higher throughput. But we can still support over 140,000 connections per second. Applications are pretty easy to port, which might be surprising. But interestingly, the effort involved to port an application is not related to the complexity or number of lines of code of the application. A good example of this is the Firefox browser, which is over 4.5 million lines of code, but only requires 70 lines of code changes to add basic server support. And this is because Firefox provides good abstractions for supporting multiple address families like IPv6 and IPv4, so adding another one is pretty straightforward. So before I end, I want to make a bit of an aside here talking about how we think server can bring SDN to the edges. So software-defined networking, or SDN, is really about network-wide visibility and control, and it operates on layer 3 and layer 2 abstractions. We think here that Servl provides an opportunity to bring this SDN model to the edges, where we provide new abstractions for services and flows and hosts and interfaces, and you can reason about this and write control programs dealing with these abstractions. So using our service level control data plane split, we think it's a good fit for this SDN model. So we think we can do joint service and network control, speaking, for example, OpenFlow to this SDN controller, as I showed in a previous slide. So I want to end with a summary of our contributions. So we have new naming abstractions for services and flows, giving a clean role separation in the stack, makes it easier to build services, manage services, and maybe even scale services in many cases. Around these abstractions, we built a software architecture for services, allowing you to build flexible service resolution and discovery, maintaining robust connectivity to services, and we think that we can do this joint service and network control with Servl. So if you want more information, please look at our website, join our Twitter feed, and you can access papers, demos, and our source code, the entire stack, everything is online and GPL. Thank you.
I have a quick question. So can you say a few words about cross-layer interaction, given that you're doing this at a fairly low level inside the stack? How does the rest of the, so for example, congestion control and so forth, interact with what's going on under the covers?
That's a good question. So, I mean, there are some mobility solutions that simply changes IP addresses underneath transport, right? And what happens to TCP then? Well, because we're actually changing the stack, we can do something more sophisticated. So, for example, when you're migrating, we can just tell transport to freeze all the state so that you're not trying to send when you don't have any connectivity. Also, if you have multiple interfaces, you can try to migrate to one interface, and if that doesn't work, you can, you know, continue operating on the old interface. So I think there's a good opportunity to actually do these kinds of cross-layer interactions and feeding information up the stack or down the stack when necessary. Other questions? No? Thank you.